I'm going to give a sort of an experimental view through through the nature of hidden order, at least what we know about it so far, in uranium, ruthenium, two, silicon, two. So uranium, ruthenium, two, silicon, two is a moderate heavy fermion material. It's got a so-called Nail temperature, which may or may not be that, of about 17.5 Kelvin, and it's actually a superconductor with a 1.5 Kelvin TC. I'm not going to have much to say about the superconductivity today. It was sort of first discovered by Palstra back in 1986, so this problem's been around for a little bit longer than high TC. And what you see here in the resistivity, you see as you cool down, there's an extremely large anomaly in the resistivity at 17.5 Kelvin in both directions. You see the resistivity somewhat anisotropic, but still three-dimensional. There's a large sort of lambda-like anomaly there. And then, of course, then you see TC down at on this particular sample below 1 degree, but the best samples that have been annealed, it comes up to about 1.5 degrees. Okay. It's tetragonal. I think I have a picture of the crystal structure in a later slide, but it's a tetragonal system. Okay. The specific heat gives you you have a sort of a linear term. This is C over T versus T squared here. And you see a large anomaly again at this 17.5 Kelvin transition, and a good chunk of the if you look, comes down to another linear term just below above TC. And a good chunk of the entropy of the system comes at the 17.5 Kelvin TC. You can fit the specific heat jump. You can make it as an activated form with a gap. And so this was again done back in about 1986. The susceptibility, linear susceptibility, increases with decreasing temperature. And then there's a kink in the susceptibility at around 18 Kelvin, but no strong peaks or anything like that. Neutron scattering, done primarily by, actually I have lots of pictures from Collins' data from early on, found that in fact there's a sort of a schematic of part, there's the actual crystal structure there, found that there is antiferromagnetic ordering at 17.5 Kelvin, but they find a very small ordered moment. So you might expect the uraniums to have some fraction of a Bohr magneton. The ordered moment is about 0.03 or 0.04 Bohr magneton. It's very small. And this is sort of the beginning of the question of what's really going on in this material. And they found the structure. It's a sort of ferromagnetic planes, antiferromagnetically aligned. Okay, this has been this is a somewhat strange-looking order parameter. But it's been, other people have looked at it. This is Tom Mason's data, and again it's sort of but again it onsets about 17.5 Kelvin. Infrared. This is some work by Doug Bond and Tom Temisk from a long time ago. They've looking at the infrared conductivity, they found that they could see a gap opening up essentially below the 17.5 Kelvin transition. So here's just above the superconducting transition. There's quite a well-formed gap at this point in the conductivity. So the whole question of what's going on in this material is really trying to understand what is this ordered state. You've got this very large signatures in the transport properties. You've got these big jumps in the specific heat, anomalies in the resistivity, and yet you see this minuscule ordered moment. And it seems the whole question is trying to sort of reconcile these two things. If with such a small ordered moment, you wouldn't expect to see such a great signature in these other properties. So this has spawned a whole industry of theoretical proposals to explain what's really going on in the 17.5 Kelvin transition. There's been all kinds of different sorts of exotic order. Anti-ferro quadrupolar is sort of my favorite. And people have sort of settled on the word hidden order, because if you don't know what it is, it must be hidden. There's a detailed analysis of neutron data by Mike Walker a number of years ago, and looking at that, the only sort of order parameter that they see in the neutron is this pure dipole order. There's no evidence for anything else in the neutron data, at least. Magnetic dipole order, yes. Yeah. So there's no evidence for any anti-ferro quadrupolar order in the neutron data. So some of the other proposals that people have come up with, there's a proposal by Coleman for circulating currents, which would have that a particular effect that you might see in neutron scattering. And people have been sort of spent a large amount of effort to look for these sorts of things. One of the first when I was a postdoc, actually, the first project I actually started working on was, in fact, this material. And we came across something really peculiar, which we never really understood at the time, and I think we do now. And we were looking, we were mostly interested at that point in looking at the exotic superconductivity of this material, trying to measure the temperature dependence of the penetration depth of this material. But we also looked at the magnetism, because of course, if there's magnetic order, it's hard to measure the field inhomogeneity due to the vortex lattice. And what we found, first of all, is that essentially we couldn't see any signs of the antiferromagnetism. If you have 0.03 Bohr magnetons and you put the muons into a sample, that should give substantial spin relaxation. Should be easy to see, and we really didn't see anything at all. So that was rather peculiar. And then one particular experiment, we actually mounted the sample. Instead of just sort of sticking it on the sample holder with some grease, we actually soldered it onto the sample holder. And then as we cooled down, what we found is that going from below 18.5 Kelvin down to low temperatures, we saw a very well-defined long-lived precessing signal. Whereas before, we'd always just seen a long relaxing exponential with not much change. And the muon star is a volume-sensitive probe, because if you put it, the muons land at some site. If they see a field, they'll precess in that field. If they land in an area with no field, they won't precess at all. So what this tells us is that in this particular sample, 10% of the muons were seeing a substantial field and precessing coherently. That gives you the small amplitude precession signal. If all the muons were seeing the field, the full amplitude signal would be precessing here. So what we found is that this frequency was actually almost independent of temperature, almost right up to the magnetic transition temperature. And what we think we understand that now is that we are, of course, applying a uniaxial pressure in the basal plane due to the differential thermal contraction of the sample and the sample holder. Because even with the same sample unmounted and measured again, we weren't able to and not mounted in this method, the precession went away on exactly the same sample. Okay. So what we see from this is that in fact, generally there is no, in a MuSR, at least in the majority of the sample volume, there's no more ordered moment. However, if you apply a certain amount of uniaxial stress, then in fact you can nucleate some order. So one possible explanation then is that the neutron scattering are seeing the small moment from a small fraction of the sample, perhaps, where perhaps there may be some strain due to stacking faults, which are known to exist in this material. Well, of course, we measure a field. So, but if you guessed, you would say that you would get some fraction of a half a Bohr magneton or something like that. The precession frequency is about, you have to make some assumptions about where the muon's living, but it's about 8 megahertz. That's in lanthanum strontium copper oxide, which is the parent compound, the signal's about half this frequency. So it's that order of magnitude. Okay? Well, here it's just the ratio between, if this amplitude here is 100% from there to there, the amplitude of this precessing signal is about 10%. On this particular sample, we had about 10% of the sample being antiferromagnetic and 90% of it being not antiferromagnetic. Okay. So this has been since then, neutron scattering experiments have been done where they put the samples into a hydrostatic pressure cell. This would be a clamped piston anvil cell, and what they find is as you increase the pressure going from 0 to 3 gigapascals or 30,000 atmospheres, you see. Here we are at ambient pressure, and this is actually the Bragg peak intensity, the antiferromagnetic point, blown up by a factor of 30 in ambient pressure, and here's blown up by a factor of 5 in a third of a gigapascal, and the rest of these are on the same scale. You see a large growth in the size of the antiferromagnetic Bragg peaks. And so this original paper actually interpreted this as an increase in the moment size, but I think now we interpret it as an increase in the volume fraction, because in fact, you can't distinguish the two of them in this experiment. This is an interesting point. This is hydrostatic pressure, but it's hydrostatic pressure in a piston anvil cell, which is not entirely hydrostatic. There's also a uniaxial component. It seems the summary result of this is that you essentially uniaxial pressure is more effective at bringing this about, but apparently even hydrostatic pressure is about. That's still a little bit up in the air, though.
So Graham, the line widths are the same in all of these, is that right?
I think there's the instrumental resolution, there's the peaks. I don't think usually at ambient pressure, nobody has ever seen instrumental resolution on those peaks. I think this one may be a bit broader, but it's a bit hard to tell with the scale here. NMR measurements on under hydrostatic pressure are like VSR. It's a volume-sensitive probe, and what they found there is that you can sort of see the lines here that that as you go through this transition, you have a center line which then splits into two satellites, and yet the center line sometimes still remains. And as a function of pressure, they could map out the antiferromagnetic volume fraction, and again they see that somewhere around four kilobar, which is 0.4 gigapascals. There's a growth in the antiferromagnetic volume fraction, but looking at the frequency, which is just the splitting of this line from the central line, they see that the local moment in the ordered regions is independent of the pressure, which you see that across there. And they found that again that at about 10,000 atmospheres, they got essentially the full volume fraction being antiferromagnetic, which means that they wiped out the center line when they went below the transition. There's another peculiar experiment which I don't really understand, but it's important to notice. There was an NMR measurement, an ambient pressure, where they found a constant line broadening which was isotropic and field independent, and which followed a mean field form, which is somehow a clue to what's going on in this hidden order state. But it's hard to know what to make of it. This line broadening, if there was a 10 Gauss field in homogeneity. That would be easily seen in, for example, in a MUSR experiment. It's not seen. So there's something peculiar about this, which I don't understand. So I won't say too much more about it. But it's sort of one of the classic parts of one of the pieces of data that people are trying to understand in the system. So we've also done MUSR under high pressure. It's difficult to do MUSR under high pressure because the usual surface muons will stop at about a tenth of a millimeter of material, and a pressure wall cell usually has about 8 millimeter walls, and so you have to use high energy muons coming from pions which decay in flight, and then you have to sort of range them in through the walls of your pressure cell and into your sample. So you have a 6 millimeter diameter sample inside a pressure cell with 8 millimeter walls, and you try to arrange your muon momentum to have the largest fraction of them land in the sample, and we can do about a third of the muons, in fact. So what we see here is some raw data, basically. This is at 9,000 atmospheres. As we go from through the transition, it's a little hard to normalize this because, of course, we have a background signal. But you see, what we find as a function of pressure and temperature, as we go below the 17.5 Kelvin, we see a very large fraction of the sample volume becomes ordered, entirely consistent with the NMR measurements. And so if we measure the precession frequency, there's a large suppressed zero here, we see that it's roughly pressure independent, going from 11 to 9 to 7 kilobar, and then it drops off at around 17.5 Kelvin. So it's quite a steep drop off. So we find that the nail temperature is largely pressure independent. It's always around 17.5 Kelvin, but there's a slight change. But MUSR is probably not the best technique to look at that. What we find, though, is that the volume fraction that orders is strongly pressure dependent. So by the time we get down to about 4 kilobar, there's no precession signal seen anymore. Okay. There's been a lot of work on, again, with various techniques, looking at here's neutron data, looking at the ordered moment as a function of temperature for different pressures. This is the result of another group of MUSR measurements, kind of PSI. And essentially, we have a phase diagram. So largely consistent. You have a low temperature, low pressure phase, which this group calls a small moment antiferromagnet. I would call it a zero moment, non-antiferromagnet. But small. The neutrons always see some ordered moment. This is a neutron paper, and they always see even an ambient pressure, a small signal. But they can't tell if that come. I mean, that may just come from stacking faults or something like that. But everybody agrees that if you go above a certain pressure, you get a large moment. So you're getting some. This is m squared of 0.1, so this is about 0.3 ordered Bohr magnetons ordered moment. So everybody agrees in this phase you have a large moment antiferromagnet, and everybody agrees down here you have a very small, if any, moment. And then there's some questions about whether these phase lines cross and touch, or whether they run parallel, or in this experiment where they in fact meet at a point up here somewhere. So these are sometimes there's some details that are now being we're trying to now understand. So one of the tools that we have to look at this actually is sorry, questions?
Go back.
Sure.
So how do you distinguish, as you're raising the temperature in this region with you're up there, how do you distinguish those two phase boundaries? Yeah.
This Tm is actually defined from resistivity. So if you go back to the resistivity plot, there's a cake somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's determined from resistivity, and the other one is ordered is measured from the the Bragg peak. Mm-hmm. So they're not in the same experiment, which is it's part of the difficulty. Okay. But
say this experiment, you've got two phase boundaries as a function of temperature.
Yeah. So this measurement here is all entirely. This part here again is T0 is from resistivity, and these points down here are from mu SR. But the problem is that the mu SR measurements run out at about here, I think, in pressure. Okay. So it's still a little bit vague. I'm going to address a little bit more of that in a later slide. So it is tricky, and of course the model you want to write down to describe this, the shape of the phase diagram matters. So quite an early paper in this game was actually by Art Ramirez, who looked at the nonlinear susceptibility of this material, and he looked looking at here's just a scan from their paper. They looked at uranium, ruthenium, silicon 2, for fields along the c-axis. The linear susceptibility looks just like it did in Brian Maple's paper. There's a kink at 17.5 Kelvin. But the nonlinear susceptibility has this large sort of lambda-like anomaly. When you looked at a conventional antiferromagnet, uranium zinc, what he sees there, there's a kink again in the linear susceptibility at the order of transition. But then they just see sort of more of an order parameter-like growth in the nonlinear term. Okay. So we thought, well, what we can do, we can measure, we decided to look at the nonlinear susceptibility as a function of pressure. So we use a helium gas system here, which has looks like a Russian submarine, because it's probably actually a Polish submarine. You have a gas bottle here, which has a series of pressure intensifiers, and we can make up to, in the squid cell, which I show here, we can make about 700 or 800, 7 or 8 kilobar. Okay. The very nice thing about the cell is extremely long and uniform. The helium gas gives extremely high quality hydrostatic pressure, because even though the helium may be solid, it's just a van der Waals solid, so it doesn't support a shear stress. So this is a gas bottle pressure. So here's the linear susceptibility. Here's the kink as before. If you subtract the linear part off, you can see the nonlinearity appearing in these different runs of temperature. And here's the chi 3, basically an ambient pressure. Again, we see the same jump as we've seen before. Okay. If we now follow this with a function.
So what's the convention here of chi 3 in terms of the sign? Like when the expansion, is it plus chi 3 or minus chi 3? Because I think that if you have a collinear antiferromagnet, you might actually get the opposite sign than if it was a spin.
So here we are as a function of pressure now, going through a series of pressures. You see that the kink moves up, this T0 moves up in pressure as we've seen before. And we see, and here's the triplet part, the transition moves up, but the size of the jump in chi3 actually stays essentially independent of pressure, up to the highest pressure we can get to successfully so far, up to about 650 megapascals. So far in this range up to 650 megapascals, we don't see any change in the susceptibility signal. Okay, I'm going to have to speed up. However, when we go to, we then switch to a piston cell where we get to higher pressures, and then we see a completely different behavior up at a gigapascal. We see again still the kink in chi1, but now we see this order parameter form in chi3, which is much more reminiscent of what was seen in the uranium zinc with conventional antiferromagnet. And there, just to show that that's what the ambient pressure signal looks like for chi3 on the same scale. When we go to a lower pressure, 780 megapascal, again in the same cell, we see a large jump in chi3 at about 14 Kelvin, and we see there's a small feature here up about 17, and if you put that on, if you put on the size of the chi3 term from before, this is the same size as that. So in fact, at this pressure, we seem to have captured both transitions, and so this allows us to sort of put that together a phase diagram. Where we see in the triangles here are measured in gas pressure, or these are all pressure measurements. Everything on this axis is in helium gas. And these two highest points here are actually a piston cell, which we should, which is a fairly small cell, so it should have less uniaxial component to it. But there is a problem that the only measurements that show the hidden or that show the long-range antiferromagnetism are always done in a piston cell. Any measurement done in a gas cell where you have better hydrostatic pressure, you're always in this state. And basically, the transition may be just above the pressure you can get to. So it may be you always need to have a uniaxial pressure to go from one state to the other. It's not, that's still an open question, I would say.
So, but this blue triangle there, up there.
These two points here were done in a liquid cell.
But it's clearly distinguished from the red circle. That's different. But that's a resistance measurement again?
Yeah, those are the resistance measurements.
Those are all sensibility measurements.
Oh, okay, sorry, pardon me, you're right. This is the kink in Chi1. Okay. Now I should say something about the neutron results that we've been doing as well. So I have two sets of scans here. This is Colin Broholm's 1987 neutron looking at the spin excitations. One of the peculiar things about the system, although there's this minuscule ordered moment, there's these very strong spin excitations. That if you sort of, as Colin did, you calculate what sort of moment they should come to from, it should be some number of half a Bohr magneton or something like that. So if we look at, so this is a measurement of DCS. And what you see is you see this this incommensurate, no, this sort of this range of excitations. This is at 1.5 Kelvin, well inside the hidden ordered state. And what you see is that in fact that these ones here come down to an incommensurate wave vector of about 0.6, and these ones over here to about 1.4, and they're centered around the antiferromagnetic point at 1.0. If we look at the intensity in this region, though, as a function of temperature, it actually is gapped. It looks like the gap form below about 17.5 Kelvin. So if we looked at if we do the same measurement up at higher temperatures, this is measurement, this is simulation, used to characterize this. What you see is that these excitations are going to get spread out. They're not as well defined, but there's still a lot there. If we calculate how much is missing from here, the central result of this paper by Chris Weave and a number of others of us is that if you calculate the amount of entropy associated with those excitations that get missed, then in fact you get a value, you can compute it, and you actually can calculate what the specific heat should be of those things that are missing at low temperatures, and you essentially get the amount of specific heat there is outside of the ordered state. So this blue point here, this is the specific heat data measured on our sample, and this blue point here is calculated by saying how much, if you take a look at this and you compare this to this and you say how much of this scattering, which is spread out all over Q space, how much of those fluctuations are lost, how much entropy should be associated with them, you directly get this value here. So essentially we can see where the specific heat comes from. It's from the gapping of some spin excitations. So we can identify the size of the specific heat jump and actually we can't quite understand the jump, but we can understand where the specific heat goes. We just can't quite understand the form of the divergence. No, it's distributed. So we're looking not at the antiferromagnetic point here so much. It's most of the a lot of the strength is around this incommensurate part here. But if you look at this is sort of a continuous band of exit. This is a continuous band. So it's really a gapping of all these excitations down here at low energies. When you iterate over the whole Brillouin zone, that's what gives you this.
I'm having a hard time understanding those two plots. So can you?
Sure. This is at low temperature. This is at 20 Kelvin. So we've got some new data, which I'll show in a second, which shows this better. This is measured at DCS, where you measure all over E and Q, but you don't have, but it's sort of sometimes these two-dimensional plots are a bit hard to read.
The difference between these two.
But essentially, yes, the difference between these two and calculating how much entropy is associated with those excitations. What we've actually had to do is we've modeled this and fit it to a so-called form from Chu, which is used in YVCO, for example, looking at paramagnetic spin fluctuations. And this is what you, when you sort of parameterize that in this form, this is what you get. But, okay. So here, just coming back to the so here's some, again, newer data just showing with higher resolution. We've also gone and done more triple access work, and this looks again very similar to the data that Colin took a long time ago. But this is now at 20 Kelvin, and this again is at low temperatures. You can see at 20, you have an elastic feature here. But if we look at this inelastic part here, which is extremely broad, these overdamped excitations, if you fit these to a simple harmonic oscillator form and you plot the energy of those, so here's again the DCS data at low temperature, but the black points are the energies of the center of this inelastic feature, you get the same form. So what we see, or almost the same form, so we see that these very sharp excitations that are well defined in the hidden order state are still seen. Are still seen, in fact, above the transition, but they're extremely overdamped. And what's happening as you go below the transition, you get a gapping of some of these excitations. It becomes full because these are very broad and they go right down to low energy. In the hidden order state, these become much sharper, as you can see on the color contour plot. And but the same excitations are present at high temperatures. So the thing we recently looked at is trying to understand the wave vectors of these excitations here, and you notice that these are symmetric about the antiferromagnetic point here, and they're at 0.6 and 1.4. And in fact, if you look at the Fermi surface, which has been determined from ARPES, in fact there's a couple of nesting vectors you can see possible here of 0.6 and 1.4 on the same scale. So the gap may be formed from, in fact, a nesting of these different parts of the Fermi surface. And so that's something that we're just trying to work out now.
And the Fermi surface in the hidden order phase, or which phase?
This is from ARPES, so I think it's measured at higher temperatures. The Hafstein-Alfin, I think Steve probably knows this better than me, but there's the Hafstein-Alfin measurements at low temperature, but those I think would be in the hidden order phase. And I think that I'm not sure that they see all parts of the Fermi surface there, in fact. Just in the last minute, I just wanted to an advertisement for something that's going to be coming up. We recently started a collaboration with Seamus Davis to look at these materials under STM. So he's taken one of our crystals, cleaved it at very low temperatures, and imaged it. So there's just a topography plot, and you can see the lattice. So it looks, from looking at from the step sizes, first of all, the atomic spacings, and then the size of when they see steps, we think we're cleaving either between the uranium-uranium splitting on the structure here, or it could be a silicon-silicon, it's probably between the uranium and between the silicon and the ruthenium layers. So, but we are getting a consistent cleave in this material, and what he's now seeing, when he starts doing his looking for quasi-particle interference, he's now starting to see that. So here's looking at, this is the same sort of thing he's done in the cuprates, and you can see these modulations. This is presumably due to the heavy electrons, this quasi-particle interference. So we're hoping to be able to understand this in terms of the dispersion of a heavy electron band, and this is sort of just work that's really just ongoing now. Okay, so that just shows that. So just to conclude, I'd say the nature of the hidden order state is still somewhat unclear. That's why it's hidden. We don't really know what the fundamental order parameter is yet of the system. It looks like it seems to be that there's some Fermi surfaces nesting going on, but if it's not, it can't just be a normal spin density wave, because in a normal spin density wave, there'd be a big signal in USR and NMR, and that's just not there in ambient pressure. So maybe it's some sort of charge density wave, but that has not been detected yet. Tom's measurements definitely see something that looks like nesting as well, and they see a gap, but there's no evidence from scattering, for example, of a charge density wave. And the other thing I should say is that there's the whole question of what's the nature of the superconducting state is still quite open, I think. There hasn't been any real probing yet to see what is the symmetry of the superconducting gap parameter in that material. I think that's going to eventually emerge as a very interesting question as well. So with that, I'll stop.
How does the pressure fit in the whole story?
Pressure seems to allow you to go from the hidden order state, or a state where you essentially have no moment, or to a state where you have a real macroscopic ordered moment. The other thing that's interesting is that the pressure you need to do that is essentially the pressure you need, I guess, to destroy superconductivity. Which I don't know quite how to put that together yet, but so pressure allows you to select a different ground state, and once you apply enough pressure, I think everybody agrees that it's a reasonably well characterized antiferromagnet. There hasn't been any inelastic neutron scattering done yet, I don't think, in the antiferromagnetic state, but that's another an obvious thing to do is to look at what do these spin excitations look like that are so well seen in the in the hidden order state at low temperatures. What happens to them when you go into the antiferromagnetic state?
How high are the crystal fields in the scaffold?
There are no crystal field levels that we can see up to, and I can't remember, we haven't seen any up to the, well, if you look at the, go back to the inelastic neutron, here we're going up to, say 10 milli electron volts. There aren't any crystal field levels. This line here that looked like it might be something, that's actually a uranium fission process. So I think they're called spurions or something like that.
So I'm trying to understand your specific heat measurements. So you have got the comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So your summary is that above the hidden order phase, in the normal phase, you have lots of low energy spin excitation that is incommensurately vector.
Well, they're all all over Q, essentially. They're not just they're
different.
Yeah.
Picture before. One before. So the bottom right. That looks pretty incommensurate.
Well, this is sort of a parameterization of the data within this particular model.
Believe that. So these excitations here are not in the hidden order phase. These are above.
Right. They're gapped out, and you can see the fact that there's no intensity down in here.
So you could go below this temperature, and they just completely disappear.
Yes.
And the entropy of these excitations is sufficient to account for the specific heat.
Yes.
So
what's the density of stacking fault?
I don't know. I think it's. I don't. I my guess is it could be 1 out of 100 or something like that. But they're not.
It's not so easy to determine. Actually, it's not that easy to determine. So I mean, there's bound to be some. It's hard to be quantitative.
But. Tom,
could you go back to our optical there? I just wanted to see if our gap was the same as your 4 millivolt spin gap. I don't remember, it was such a long time ago. Yeah, it is. 34 times.
No, there's a very nice, Colin did a very nice comparison in one of the, I think it was in Colin's paper, where he basically took your spin gap and put the, and did a lot of modeling of the neutron data and got sort of the same gap, and you could sort of plot another curve right on. He didn't have the phone on peak, I don't think, but other than that, it looked exactly the same. So the neutrons and the optics are consistent.
It's the same value, 32.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Graham again then.